Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
How you doing, internet? It is July 17th, 2017. You are listening to Waypoint Radio, and I am clearly not Austin Walker. I am instead Danielle Riendo. Austin is taking care of business, as they say, in the business. I don't know. All right, I'm joined by Patrick Klepek.
Is that on like the business wiki? Like, is that,
yeah,
is that listed on like a business.wikia.com?
Yes.
It teaches you how to business.
Biz.nas.
That, no.
Computer. No?
Please delete that from the podcast. Remove it. Biz.nas is that...
Biz.nas!
Rob, is that a domain name that you can register?
Well, I'm not going to register that domain name. Like I don't want to end up on some sort of watch list.
Well, biz.ass. How about that? Biz-ass.
I like that.
Please.
You also heard the voice of Rob Zachney there being the voice of reason, as usual.
Oh, I don't know. Ever since the subterfuge business started over, I don't know if I would assign Rob that quality as quickly as you just did.
Oh, I'm a lot less reasonable than I was when this bullshit started, let me tell you that.
I don't know if you're talking about subterfuge or the podcast or just,
yes,
you know, maybe where your car is.
All of it. Well, Rob, I guess that's a good segue as any into what you should... You have a little quick subterfuge update for us, perhaps?
Do
you not want to talk about it because it's too painful?
Look, I mean, I'm already paying to talk about it with my therapist, so I might as well talk about it with you folks. So yeah, like, just a quick subterfuge update. There's not a ton going on. Well, no, that's not true, actually.
Yeah, it seems like
there's a lot going on for other people.
Okay.
Like, if this were a movie, I would be in the foreground dealing with some, like, tedious bullshit, while in the background, like, Godzilla is leveling the city. Like, that's kind of what's happening. Because everybody who didn't, like, share a border with Nick Capizzoli is currently having this massive underwater, like, you know, battle for control of the oceans, basically. Hundreds of submarines, like, racing between outposts, massive fleets running into each other. The population of troops in this world is just, like, plummeting. Meanwhile, I have spent most of the weekend just building this cordon around Nick. Because...
So you're taking your downtime to prepare for... Like, is this the end... Are we in the end game?
We're rapidly approaching it. Like, so quick thing...
So
that
is like, Game of Thrones current season, penultimate season. Is that currently where we are in subterfuge? Like,
yes.
It's not the actual end game, but it's the chess pieces moving to the end game.
Yeah, exactly. Because one key thing about subterfuge is that... You win it by building these mines that produce Neptunium, I want to say. It's some bullshit, like, unobtainium thing. But once you hit a certain threshold, you've got enough of this stuff to win the game. So you win it on points, basically. Once people start planting mines, the game is on a timer until they hit those thresholds. And so, like, for a few days, only one person had, like, a single mine, and their victory was, like, 10 days out. And then... In the last couple days, the rate of mining, like, increased, like, threefold. And that triggered everyone just going at each other. Because, like, at a certain point, you just won't have time to disrupt their plan. So all hell's breaking loose with the other players. Meanwhile, I've just been boxing in Nick Capizzoli, who, for whatever reason...
Wow,
decided,
he's become...
arch nemesis.
What did Nick do to you?
It's kind of perplexing. So the thing to know about Nick is that...
Please go on.
He's actually incapable of winning subterfuge.
Wow. Okay.
Like it's
good.
Like you know how you know how in like Civilization there's those AI leaders that everybody just hates. Like once they show up, you just know you can never deal
Gandhi,
with them.
Gandhi, right?
Like,
isn't that everyone hates in Civilization? Gandhi? Is that am I right? Am I getting that right?
Gandhi has a reputation, but it's Montezuma actually who like if he's on your border, he's going to come after you, and you just can never trust him. Nick, sort of has
Nick
a similar
Montezuma?
Glitch.
Okay.
He's Nick Capizzoli
is a human glitch.
Nick Montezuma. Yeah.
Yeah. So the weird thing is, in sort of the meta history of these subterfuge games, everyone is carrying these grudges against him. And so nobody will really engage with him or plot with him. Like, I think he was trying to come after me earlier in the game and like had an alliance set up against me, and his allies betrayed him and attacked
wow.
him instead.
Wow.
Because every game he like sows more bad will towards him, and then his reaction is kind of to troll somebody. And today this was me. So he, after he was sort of chased off his turf, he just came down and sent this massive fleet into my territory. And basically I had to spend the weekend building this cordon all around him so he had nowhere to run to. And he was in this, like, impregnable fortified position. And it was just me waiting a weekend for another player who hates Nick more than I do. And to be fair, I think that's most of them, actually. I came out of this cooler with Nick than a lot of other players. But there's a lot of bad blood. And so when I was like, I need somebody to come help me, deal with this Nick infestation... somebody was like, I've got 400 submarines. They're yours. And basically, like, rolled up behind him. So
that's fascinating, the idea of the sort of, like, the meta layer of a game carrying over in that regard. Like, I imagine that maybe doesn't happen one or two games, but it's the culmination of, like, a number of games where you just sort of, like, the tactics of people wear you out or... that's just an interesting layer to the game that doesn't happen in a lot of... games. It also can only happen if you're playing with like similar people over and over and over again.
Yeah, it's a really interesting wrinkle to this because I've only played a couple games with this crew, but like they all have a fair bit of history. So there's this like nobody is starting from a clean slate to the point where I think they are actually playing somewhat irrationally at times. Like,
oh wow,
like
just to mix things up.
No, more that like. In terms of, like, this individual game, they are making moves that I would not say are optimal because it is satisfying grudges and bad blood from earlier games. So, like, the alliance that Nick had built against me, I think was the right way to go for all parties concerned. Like at that moment, the best thing they all could have done for them would probably have been to turn on me and steamroll my territory, and that would have been it, and everyone would have gone home happy. For some reason, the people that Nick was allied with didn't want to do it. I think the problem was they just didn't want to be Nick's ally. And so, you know, that's how that went. And so, like, it's weird. Each individual game should be sort of this blank slate and people operating according to their own self-interest. But yeah, as a group of people play together more and more often... there's other considerations in past history being sort of baked into the decision making in some really interesting ways. And I actually think, you know, that's a good thing. I think that's one of the things that makes subterfuge interesting. But it also means that the game becomes even more unpredictable because you don't know, you know, you know what the state of play is, but you don't actually know what like the emotional state of your fellow players is. And it gets really interesting because of that.
I never want to play this game ever. Like, considering what it's done to your sleep schedule and like feelings about life, like, I never want to play this game.
Well,
but I love
you,
hearing about it.
You can schedule moves to happen while you're asleep. And so one of the things I did to Nick was just I made sure that I'd have a massive attack targeting one of his stations launch at around like 3 or 4 this morning. I could have launched that at a different time, but I didn't want to. And so I woke up.
4 in the morning is like just late enough that even if someone was up extremely late playing a game or doing whatever, it's very unlikely that at this stage in our lives you're going to be up at 4 in the morning. Before AM is also too early for even like morning people to be up. Even for someone with kids to be up, you're looking at between 5 and 6. And 4 is just that sweet spot.
And yet it's tough to go back to sleep, too.
Oh, God.
Because once you're up at
evil.
Once you're up at 4:30 dealing with somebody's submarine attack, what are you going to do? You got to be work at 8.
Like, did he get up? Did he get up and deal with it at 4?
He sure did. So I rolled out of bed at like 6:30 this morning, checked my phone, and he'd made a bunch of moves to deal with that attack. And yeah, that was basically again, there's meta layers to this game.
Oh God, so many layers. There's a good segue there about layers and about hating other people, maybe to Evo, but I don't know if hate is the right word. I know Evo was this weekend. Evolution 2017, I actually watched a tiny bit of it. I don't understand anything that's going on. I rely entirely on the commentary to make any sense
out
of anything, because I'm not in the FGC.
Yep.
Not really in that community at all, but I'm interested. I definitely had Evo on in one window, and I had like UFC Fight Night Scotland in another window, and then like my little workout routine in another. So I was taking it in for sure. But Rob, you know a little bit more about this than I do. Do you have any thoughts on Evo? Were there any sort of clear, interesting stories for you, or was it just also kind of taking it in?
Oh man, like Evo is really daunting because there's too much to take in.
Sure.
Every fighting game scene is kind of its own little world, and it's tough to keep track of all of it. Plus, there's just a lot of goddamn fighting games at Evo.
Yeah,
like, in addition to the myriad, like what they call main stage games, the games that are going to be having their finals on the main stream, on the main stages at Evo in front of the big crowd, there's also a lot of side tournaments. One of the big ones is Anime Evo.
I didn't even know. Okay.
Yeah, sweet. So there's this there's a really good tournament of anime and Air Dasher fighting games that don't have like huge audiences, but there's a ton of these games and they attract a really passionate community. And that's not even like officially part of Evo. It's done as sort of a annex to Evo. Like, it's all community run, community organized. And there's some really good stuff there as well. There was a Fist of the North Star tournament going on, where you may have seen some clips going around Twitter of this one guy whose finishing move was basically an infinite combo. And over the course of this tournament, again and again, he would just start like going nuts on his opponents for the last hit and just like start chaining these like 50, 60, 100 hit combos. To the point where, like, people started, like, you know, they just take off their headsets and start talking with other people while waiting for the match to end. And this dude is, like, you know, frantically running up the score. One dude just, like, leans back, sort of, like, flags down a buddy and has him pass him his fidget spinner. The one that got the most play, I think, was a dude basically just started to look at this combo unfold, took his wallet out of his pocket and offered his opponent money to just stop, just like just make this end. And that's kind of the weird shit you find at Evo. And to be fair, it's one of the reasons why, like, if you can go to a tournament, an esports event, Evo is a really good one to go to, because there is so much to take in at like the side tournaments. There's a lot of like cash matches happening off to the side.
Nice.
As well. So it's just it's a cool place to be, and it's one of the few esports events I'd say where like clearly you're getting a lot of extra experiences and value by being there that you just can't get watching on stream. But the streams are great too. There's a lot of good action.
Yeah, was there anything that particularly caught your eye, or it? I mean, yeah.
Well, there were a few things. I guess I'm sort of writing up a piece about this for today, but I think one of the big things that struck me was that this esports organization, Echo Fox, really invested a lot of money and effort in beefing up their fighting game ranks. And sort of their marquee player, appropriately enough, is this player, Sonic Fox, who was just like the king of Mortal Kombat X. Like he could not be stopped. And for about 2 years, and it wasn't just that, he was also really, really good at Injustice 1 as well. So for like 2 years, he was just basically cleaning up at every NetherRealm Studios fighting game tournament. And this year, people were expecting he would come into Evo and kind of do the same thing with Injustice 2. And he didn't. He went out in the quarterfinals, which, you know, would be fine, except if you're kind of a generational talent that everyone, like, expects to just dominate again and again and again, the moment you have, like, results that are just, like, great as opposed to, like, awe-inspiring, immediately it's like, ooh, what's going on? Is he okay? Like, is the era over? Sonic Fox was kind of a, by those inflated standards, kind of a massive disappointment. And the rest of his team did really well. So it was kind of a weird twist. The thing that I think, you know, it seemed like Echo Fox could really count on ended up fizzling, while in a lot of other games they had a lot of success. Their guy, Tokido, won the Street Fighter V tournament, beating this player, Punk, who's a really young guy playing for Panda Global. And Punk's really exciting because, like, a lot of Street Fighter players in particular, I would say, skew old. There are a lot of guys.
What does old mean? For clarification here, what is old and what is young in this part of the esports world?
Old is old. Okay. Like,
old is actually old, not 25.
it's like 30s. Okay. Like, so it's not like some other esports where old is, you know, 22.
Where you burn out after your teens because your fingers have fallen apart.
Yeah, no, for sure. Like, God, there's even some factions in StarCraft that, like, physically, it appears that, like, playing them at a high level, like, kind of burns you out. Like, I think a lot of Terran players developed, like, weird, like, shoulder and hand issues just because of the way the Terran faction is. So, like, a lot of these players don't have really long careers. Meanwhile, in FGC, and particularly Street Fighter, people who are really good in, like, the late 90s and through the 2000s, a lot of them are still around and are still really good. You know, and Takedo is kind of one of those characters. He's in his 30s. He's got a great reputation, but he's not your sort of stereotypical, like, young kid esports star. Meanwhile, this guy Punk is, I think, just like 18. And in the space of like the last year, has emerged as maybe the best American fighting game player, like, around right now. It's going to be really interesting to see where he evolves from here. But it was this cool clash between, like, you know, the old warhorse and the young kid, and it just sort of seemed like the more experienced player, in this case, Takedo, just he had too much ability to, like, kind of analyze his opponent during the course of the match and, like, just figure out how to handle him. Like, Punk started strong, but, like, every round you're watching it just get harder. And maybe that was nerves, but it also just sort of seemed like the young guy didn't have that ability to analyze and change it up the way that somebody who's been doing this for an extra, like, you know, 12, 15 years can do.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's really, really cool. I know, Patrick, you have been playing something awesome and competitive that hits with the young demographics. I should probably stop trying to make these transitions. Patrick, you've been playing Splatoon 2. I know that's awesome.
I haven't played Splatoon 2, but to touch on Evo for a second.
Oh, yeah, please.
What I find so fascinating about Evo as a event is sort of the balance it has to do with commercialization, which is true of, like, a lot of tournaments, but also, you know, the way Evo works is there's a cyclical nature and balancing act of, like, you know, the old games that people are still playing, and then the way Evo survives as a big mainstream event, which is that it needs players transitioning to the big new games that the publishers are pushing. And specifically, what is interesting about right now is everyone was so excited about the new Marvel vs. Capcom game, but like I've never seen more heat generated at a fighting game and its roster in the way that Marvel vs. Capcom has gotten there. Like, that game is on such poor footing right now with its community, which made me then interested in like how they handle rollouts for it going forward, which is essentially trying to bridge new goodwill prior to that game's release so that hopefully people will give it a chance. And so I'm not shocked that the character they announced this weekend for the new MVC game was a Darkstalkers character, which is like the right kind of like weird, like hardcore fandom sort of character that you're going to announce when you can't give them the X-Men character because Marvel won't let you put the X-Men characters in there as they slowly try to kill that franchise in a weird meta corporate game they're playing with 20th Century Fox. But I, as someone that doesn't follow the games themselves and the players themselves, I end up really being interested in seeing how all of that plays out. Like, Robert, do you have any sense of, like, where that dynamic is? Not necessarily with Marvel vs. Capcom, unless there's something you observed there, but just sort of that dynamic of, like, oh, here are the new games. Like, please give a shit about these games because these are the people that sponsor us and allow this event to take place at these giant arenas.
Yeah, I mean, I think the tension has been getting more pronounced, I would say. And largely, it's probably Capcom driving that dynamic because sort of the flagship, a lot of the flagship games for the fighting game community are Capcom Fighters. And so you had a really popular game in Street Fighter IV, which was in a great place in terms of competitiveness and you know, balance. People loved that game and they were really happy with it. But
and 5 has been kind of a nightmare, like for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things that's kind of poisoned the well for Marvel Infinite is that Capcom dropped the ball so badly with Street Fighter 5 that people just don't trust it. And then what they're showing is not really, you know, it's one of those things where there's a love for Marvel versus Capcom 3 that, like, I don't fully, like, understand. Like, it's cool to see. People really adore that game. That community refuses to let it die. But it's this really fierce, like, loyalty and attachment. It's such a different sort of game from a lot of other fighting games that are out there. And people wanted more to happen with it. But now they're sort of confronted with the fact that Capcom's not going to make another Marvel vs. Capcom 3 in a lot of ways. It's going to be a different thing. And in the wake of Street Fighter V, there's, like, this panic that, you know, once the new game shows up, it kind of kills major tournaments for the old game, the game that people loved. And this sort of happens with StarCraft as well to an extent. And so it is this tension because, like, FGC tournaments, more than most, are run on, like, enthusiasm. That, like, these are very grassroots tournaments. Like, Evo is largely driven by people showing up and paying entry fees to compete at Evo. That's what makes this scene work. And so if the game doesn't hit with people, you can't really cover it up with just sponsorship money. Like, what you'll end up with is a lot of, like, your top players will continue to play because they're, you know, soaking up prize money. But below that level, things kind of hollow out. And I think that's a constant tension within the FGC. I think it does create some interesting possibilities for other franchises. Like, I mean, you know, Tekken had a great finals. You know, people were super into Tekken 7. So it's an interesting place because, like, Capcom's been able to dominate the space in a lot of ways, but if they can't get their community on side, the FGC can and will kind of move to games that, you know, that have more energy around them. It's the nature of the way it works.
Well, I want to read this. There was a quote going around this weekend. It was an excerpt from a column that Patrick Miller, who works at Riot now and has been a namestay in the fighting game community for a number of years. He wrote a column for Giant Bomb a couple of years back. It's called What Fighting Game is Right for Me? And he talks about a bunch of different fighting games. And I just want to read this excerpt for how he talks about Marvel, because I think like Marvel has a very specific fandom that... Well, let me just read it. So he writes, Marvel is obsession. Marvel is the highest highs and the lowest lows. Marvel is the largest predictor of unemployment, underemployment, and semi-professional poker playing among my friends. Marvel is the battleground between the cosmic forces of order and chaos. And if you play Marvel, you might just learn where you stand. You don't quit Marvel, you recover from it. The spirit of Marvel is in you. I chased the spirit of Marvel for about 2 years, practicing zero lightning loops daily and driving out to console sessions and tournaments wherever I could. I practiced with a good friend of mine a few days a week. We'd play for hours, wordless except for occasional exclamations of salt. One day he left for Korea and didn't come back for a year. When he did, my zero tore him apart. He didn't play much after that. The spirit of Marvel had left him. A few months later, I found myself beating up some kid at Frosty Fostings, a tournament in Chicago. I was up 2-0 and about to close out the third game, and then my hand stopped, seemingly of their own accord. I tried to press buttons and move the stick, but everything felt late, as if I had suddenly found myself playing Marvel underwater. The kid came back to win that match. I stared at the rematch screen and realized I had stopped caring whether I won or lost that match. It felt meaningless. I half-heartedly played through the rest of the set. The spirit of Marvel had left me. At the end of the Marvel Finals at Evo this year, a shirtless man spontaneously appeared on stage, as if to challenge the newly crowned Evo champion, Christopher NY Chris G. Gonzalez, to defend his title. Most onlookers were confused. Marvel players were not. We understood that Chris G's win had opened his soul to the spirit of Marvel. As security hustled him off stage, we smiled, knowing that Marvel is alive and well within our hearts. I just think it's a really brilliant passage that I think does a good job of explaining like the passion people have for that particular franchise, for that particular game, and I think it does a really good job. And Patrick's writing, just generally speaking, does a really good job of explaining fighting games to a wider audience. But yeah, so when I watch with sort of a befuddlement and amazement at how Capcom is just really mishandling their like what should be the easiest rollout of a new game, which is like a new Marvel game, and then you read stuff like that and go, oh, you can see how wrong this can go so fast given sort of the passion people have for that specific property.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like an easy problem to solve for, I guess, for anybody at any level of the FGC.
Yeah, but you mentioned before that I was playing Splatoon 2, which I don't have a whole lot to say for this podcast, and also the reviews are embargoed till tomorrow morning, but I did not get deep into the original Splatoon's multiplayer, but got deep into Splatoon, the original's single player, which was deeply underrated and had a ton of creativity. The bosses were fantastic. It had just enough meat to it that it was fun to play, but it wasn't like it didn't sort of swamp your time. It was just a really good get in and get out, really, really well done. And so far of what I've played of Splatoon 2 single player, it is more of that in the way you want. I don't even want to spoil what the bosses are that I've played so far, because the creativity on display in sort of the boss structure is half the fun. But I'll say it's alive and well. The spirit of Marvel is alive and well in Splatoon 2. it is the most approachable shooter I have, you know, ever played, and that was true of Splatoon 1, and so far what I've played of Splatoon 2 is that, despite the fact that it's a sequel, I don't think it should scare people off from giving it a try. If you are fascinated by the idea of playing a competitive game, and a game like Overwatch, which I think for a lot of people was like, oh, I've never played one of these games before. It's cool that there's a game that kind of onboarded me in a way that felt safe, and you were able to kind of understand whether or not Overwatch stuck for you. I think for a lot of people, it gave them a framework to understand these types of games. And I think Splatoon operates in a very similar manner, in which whether or not it ends up sticking with you as like a game that you're going to play for weeks or months on end, it is the on-ramp to playing and
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
understanding Splatoon and the dynamics of a competitive shooter are such that I always recommend it as the kind of game that can at least give you a framework for why people are into those types of games, because Splatoon makes it very easy to play, and the sequel so far seems to do a lot more of that. So I'm hoping to spend some more time with it. We're not hoping. I am going to spend more time with this afternoon because I have to write about it for tomorrow morning. But I think as a single-player game, it seems to hit the mark again, and as a multiplayer game, it's interesting to watch Nintendo develop a very traditional sequel. That is not usually the sort of thing they do. They usually don't make these types of games, whereas Splatoon 2 is like the most traditional sort of sequel I think they've made in a long time, which is not a negative. It's more just that's how it works with these types of games. Like, when you make a competitive shooter, like, there's a certain framework for building a sequel, and Nintendo is making one of those, and they seem to be doing, as far as I can tell, like, a really good job of it. Did anyone else... you said, Danielle, you didn't play a lot of it.
Yeah.
Rob, did you touch on Splatoon at all?
A little bit. I'm mostly sort of watching my girlfriend play it, and she's also loving it, and I also agree with the single-player assessment. I think... actually, Splatoon 1 was one of the most sort of underrated secret 3D platformers that's been out in a little while. It reminded me always of Jet Grind Radio a little bit in a weird way, sort of the momentum of it. But yeah, I've been sort of mostly watching her play it as I'm, you know, doing other things, basically, and sort of being jealous and being like, I need to play this. I add it to my sort of infinite list. But what is actually different about this game versus the first one? I played quite a bit of the first one, for sure.
I mean, I don't think it's fundamentally there's a whole lot different about it. Like, it is an iterative sequel in that there are new weapons, there are tweaks. It's more of the same in the way that you would want more of the same from a Splatoon game. Like, it's not shaking the boat. One thing I'll say, that we were talking about this in our Discord a week or two ago, was just how good it looks. Nintendo as a company, as we hit sort of diminishing returns on, like, sort of technological leaps and what that means in terms of visual fidelity, like, Nintendo, they benefit from the fact that they're usually operating from behind the curve, and so that when they're the hardware they're working on, the technology does advance, and you see their aesthetic, their art, their approach matched with that, it is remarkable because they are often working on inferior hardware. They are relying on art and art direction in a way that other games can sometimes make up for by sort of like technical prowess. And so then watching Nintendo's amazing art aesthetic matched with, you know, just things like blur, like, which we take for granted in all sorts of other games, but seeing how Nintendo subtly uses new sort of visual technology, which is not even new, it's new to them, but watching it applied to their aesthetics, which are my preferred aesthetics, like Nintendo's approach to, like, aesthetic design is some of my favorite in video games, and so watching that matched with just like the subtle things they can do with art and visuals is on display in games like Super Mario Odyssey and games like Splatoon 2, where when you see it kind of slowed down and showed in comparison to the original Splatoon, you see the difference that it makes, even if you don't necessarily pick up on it while you're playing. So yeah, it just seems like a really polished sequel. I'll hopefully have more to say later this week when I'll have given a little more time with it, but anyone that liked Splatoon, I think, is going to be just happy with Splatoon 2, and anyone that didn't give it a chance because, hey, there were lots of people that didn't own a Wii U, this is a really good chance to dive in and see one of the more unique games that Nintendo has made over, you know, the last decade, in which they went into a genre that I don't think anyone would have given them much credit for being able to do something with, and they made a competitive shooter that is wholly Nintendo and yet doesn't feel as though it is overly simplified in a way that, you know, you couldn't invest a serious amount of time and feel like you're getting something out of it over that period of time.
Absolutely. Even though I know we all have beef with the way they spelled it, without the two as the O-O, seems like, yeah, I need to spend more time with it too. One more thing I wanted to touch on before we go to the question bucket. It was actually the sort of other big news over the weekend about Kingdom Hearts 3. There was some shade thrown, it seems like. The Kingdom Hearts 3 director basically threw some shade over at Square, saying, hey, it's their fault that our game is taking so long and taking several years beyond sort of what it was originally looking like.
When this game comes out, theoretically it's going to come out in 2018. That was one of the big headlines from the D23 conference, which is sort of Disney's own. Well, it's saying Disney.
Disney's own Comic-Con-ish?
Saying it's Disney is maybe selling it short because Disney now encompasses Disney, Lucasfilm, and Marvel. So it's like each of those companies on their own and do. Like Disney or I guess Marvel doesn't have its own conference, but Star Wars has one everywhere. So D23 took place just prior to Comic-Con, which is, I think, Comic-Con this week or next week in San Diego.
Yeah, it's coming right up.
And they confirmed a 2018 release window for Kingdom Hearts 3. I would caution anyone who is familiar with Tetsuya Nomura's work to not get too excited about that 2018 date. That seems like that game will maybe like an E3 next year. We'll get a fall 2018 window that slips to a spring 2019 actual release date. That seems like what might actually happen. But he did give an interview in which he pointed to some of the reasons for this game taking forever, other than the fact that all Tetsuya Nomura games take forever. So this idea that he's secretly finding like some sort of actual explanation for this game that doesn't apply to all his other games that have taken way too long to be released. That the game did switch from an internal development engine to an external Unreal Engine 4 about a year into release, which I wouldn't be shocked if that did create a very significant hurdle. Square, like a lot of Japanese companies for a long, long time, would create brand new game engines for each new game. That was just how Japanese development worked until very recently, whereas the West moved off to sort of the Unreal Engine and other middleware, Unity, and the like a long time ago. Not that there aren't proprietary engines, but by and large, that's not how it works anymore. Japan is still, in many ways, catching up to that. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that messed up a lot of pipeline, a lot of how the games are made. And hopefully that means, you know, going forward, because Final Fantasy VII's remake is also being developed on UE4, things like that go a little faster.
Smoother. Yeah.
Yeah, and Nomura also pointed to, I guess there were some resource allocation issues and that, you know, maybe something like Final Fantasy, you know, 15, while that was getting out the door, that was maybe taking up a lot of people. He didn't point to that project in particular, but said that, you know, sometimes Square has to kind of throw people at projects in order to get them out the door because they're often working on, you know, gigantic RPGs, and Final Fantasy 15 had all of its own problems for a long time before that project finally got out the door, which also was associated with Tetsuya Nomura. So maybe, Nomura, maybe you need to look at your own process and think about that.
Do you have a sense here of whether or not this is sort of very politely or very subtly sort of throwing shade and being annoyed by these sort of process issues? Or is this just sort of, oh, you know, hey, I'm just throwing people off my tail here a little bit? Do you have any sense of that?
Wish I understood what people see in Kingdom Hearts outside of being able to play in Disney World, which I get. I am really into Disney. I love when you give me the pitch on Kingdom Hearts. That sounds great. I really want to play that game. And then I played Kingdom Hearts 1 and 2, and these stories don't make any sense. I don't like how these games even play. And will I play Kingdom Hearts 3? Yeah, probably. It's been just long enough that I've forgotten how much I disliked Kingdom Hearts 2. Let's go pilot a goddamn gummy ship again. I don't get how so many people are apologists for how those games play. I get the Disney thing, and I get mashing up Square and Disney. I'm with you on that, but I am not with you on the way these games play, and I'm desperately hoping Kingdom Hearts 3 is going to play like a game that is fun to play, but everything about it I see so far. Like, over the weekend, Nomura gave an interview. He's like, hey, yo, we're bringing the gummy ship back. It's like, no one was waiting for that. No one... Like, is this what took 5 years? Is like a bunch of meetings over whether the gummy ship needs to come back? Just... am I the only one that has issues with the Kingdom Hearts series? No one else, please?
I've never played any of them.
I just haven't played Disney.
I like Disney. I like the Disney part. It's the Final Fantasy part that doesn't appeal to me as much, I'll be honest. So, I would try it. You know what? Like, I'm open-minded. I love Disney. Been to Disney World too many times to count. But, I don't know, man. Like, really, really, really high budget JRPGs don't do a thing for me, really.
The one thing that is kind
of like smaller, weirder ones,
yeah,
but
fair.
Like really big, like frankly, like the Final Fantasy series and its ilk just kind of don't do much for me. So I don't know.
The one thing that has been going around today is they announced that there's going to be a Toy Story area
that's cool
in Kingdom Hearts 3 and. If people that have been following games probably since Toy Story came out, Toy Story for the longest time, this kind of fell away a number of years ago, but for the longest time, the comparison, as games were making fidelity leaps in the PS1 to PS2 to PS3 area, back when we were getting really, really big, meaningful leaps, not like this 4K nonsense, which people try to convince themselves is like that, but it's not at all the same to what we were seeing back then, 10, 15 years ago, is that often you would see people saying, oh, finally, with the PS2, like, we're going to get Toy Story-level graphics. Oh, like, that was the comparison made.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting now on the, you know, on the PlayStation 4, Xbox One, to see an actual Toy Story level. And there are comparisons going around. I saw this on a thread on NeoGAF where it was started, where people were taking screen grabs of Toy Story 1 and then comparing it to the screenshots released for the Toy Story area in Kingdom Hearts 3. And, I mean, you know, if you had shown people those screenshots back then, they would have been just as impressed. Like, there's some aesthetic differences in terms of how the movie looks and how the game looks, but it is kind of incredible to use that as a bar for how far visuals really have come, because essentially in Kingdom Hearts 3, they're making a real-time, you know, Toy Story movie that you're interacting with, and that's kind of an incredible benchmark for where visuals have come, is to see that actually come to reality, and that actually when it did come to reality, no one really noticed because we gave that up as any sort of realistic benchmark a long, long time ago. Because, like, what does it mean to look like Toy Story? It just means that, I don't know what it means, but we did it, and now nobody cares, but it's kind of interesting to look back in retrospect.
Yeah, I would love to have a 3D animator on the podcast to, like, come here and just sort of be like, all right, here's what would actually need to happen. Or, you know, like, what that would actually look like or seem like would be really, really fascinating, I think. So I think we're ready for our question bucket. We've got about 75 in here. We've actually been doing a pretty good job on permadeath, like, taking questions and just burning through them. So we've got about 75 in here. Rob, give me a number between 1 and 75, and we will answer this question.
All right, 62.
And this one comes in from Brett. Brett asks, if Trump's administration, or any administration, were to take aggressive steps to shut down dissenting opinions and facts in the media, is there a way to prepare for that and keep working through that sort of adversity? I wouldn't expect direct action towards gaming outlets, but in some ways, Gamergate had a hand in all this, and
no,
tangible
that's,
rewards.
See, that's what we don't think. That's where they're going to go first. Like, they're going to come for us first.
That's where we're number one line of defense for freedom of press in America. Gamergate had a hand in all this, and tangible rewards for petty behavior in favor of Trump, already taking the form of retaliatory punishment in the form of market-influencing Twitter posts, seems to be firmly on the table. All right, that's Brett's question.
It's a dark question, Brett.
That is hard.
It's Monday. Couldn't you have given this to us on Friday when I can just crack open a beer and move on with my life?
Ah. Well, we got to crack open an answer and move on with our life. I think the thing to say here is all journalism is important in its own right. The fact that we have a freedom of press in this country is one of the most sacred and important things that we have. It is a check against unrestricted insanity, basically, in terms of power and in terms of the kind of corruption that happens.
How old is this
government
question? When was this submitted? Do we have a timestamp?
At 62, this was somewhere in the middle, because we've been running through sort of on the end towards.
I'm just. I only ask because like the way we felt, you know, on election night, the way we felt prior to Trump being inaugurated, and in the days after, I think there was a lot of totally valid and fear over whether he would immediately pivot to a like straight up authoritarian rule and use his populist rhetoric to dismantle, take over, like do sorts of things that authoritarians tend to do. And what we've been saved by in what the 6-7 months has been, is that actually, like, they're all incompetent. Like, they are incapable.
Yeah, the gross incompetence has helped us.
Gross incompetence has, like, essentially saved the Republic. They have not been able to pass a bill that they have campaigned on for the better part of 7 years, and to actually do, like, everything that Trump, most of what Trump has done, other than if you want to talk to, like, the larger sort of, like, rhetorical societal changes that will burn permanence long beyond however long he is around. Most of what Trump has done has been things that could be undone immediately that there is a new president. Like, he has actually done very little of permanence outside of sort of a rapid decline in rhetoric. And like, that's all bad, too. But yeah. In terms of policy, like, he's been an exceedingly poor president, and the Congress has not helped him in matters. That's why I asked about when this question was written, because at this point, yeah, I just don't think they're competent enough to enact the sorts of nightmare scenario things that we were worried about. Like, their back's against the wall. Who knows, I guess. But, like, institutions and the press have proven a pretty remarkable and sturdy check against an administration that I think a lot of people were rightly terrified about, and that lots of bad things have happened and will continue to happen. But in terms of how I felt last November or last February versus where we are now, like, I breathe a little bit easier than I did before.
So I guess the thing that has me still sort of concerned about stuff like this, well, not this exact question, but sometimes it feels like we're all being chloroformed to death, to an extent. So, yes. What we've learned with, like, there's no need to shut down the media and crack down on dissent if you've basically annihilated the concept of public shame your most important supporters. Like, the press only, it's truth to power and like ombudsman functions only really work when other authorities are willing to actually act on information that's brought to light. But if you make it so that literally your especially dumb child can go online and basically tweet out, the fact that you are openly coordinating with a foreign power to influence an election and nothing happens, that it's not this, like, instant show-stopping scandal, indicates that, like, to a degree, the need to muzzle the press has been sort of taken care of, because in the end, if nothing changes and you set the expectation that nothing's going to change because of the norms your supporters have adopted, then eventually you just ride out the storm and everyone's going to go back to, you know, writing Game of Thrones takes. That's just the news cycle we're in now. The thing that, though, that does scare me is that, you know, Trump was symptomatic of some other things, but for me, it's the Peter Thiels of the world that concern me a little more. The fact that basically you're a vindictive billionaire away from having your outlet sued into oblivion. What happened to Gawker, where basically, you know, he was basically placing bets on all these different lawsuits until he got a winner. That's incredibly scary, because no media organization has the resources to fight off that kind of sustained attack. And I think that might be a future we're headed for more often, is that, you know, it's not necessarily the government's going to want to crack down on the press. It's going to be all these shitty, like, you know, billionaire wannabe dictators.
We don't have too many of those in video games, although we do have one who is often very concerning, let's say, Twitter. Notch. Sorry, some weird in my
crotch? Is that, yeah.
Please don't sue us. Please don't sue us. Please don't sue us.
Yes, exactly. I like that whole sort of the metaphor about befouling the well so much that nobody wants to drink from it anymore, I think has scarily too much weight in our current world. And yeah, sort of the nature of truth in 2017 scares me a great deal. I really do hope we come out of this post-truth political moment and go back to some semblance of agreeing on some level what decency might look like. So, yeah, thanks, Brett. Thanks for that Nice little light Monday. Light Monday question. Let's do one more. Patrick, you wanna give a number between 1 and 74 at this point? 40. All right, let's go to 40. This is 40. Oh, all right, this one's from Jesse. Jesse says, hey there, waypointers. Do you have any pointers on properly making arguments and how to know when not to even bother? I'm starting to find myself responding to every single counter-argument, even when they are, in my opinion, low effort and most likely just trying to get a reaction. Also, is Vice getting rid of comments going to have any effect on your plans for a forum? Regards, Jesse. Well, Jesse, part two is easy. Part two is real easy. We have a forum now. Part one is something I struggle with on a daily basis.
You recently really got into it, like last week, right?
I sure did. Yeah, last week I lost like 3 hours of sleep getting into a shit fit with somebody who disagreed with me about basically the opioid crisis in America. And I retweeted a piece about it. I don't need to go into.
Was that the same night you were fighting about Spider-Man? Were these two concurrent? Were you fighting the two-front shitpost war?
No, Spider-Man was different. And also, I feel like I covered my ass so much better with the Spider-Man one because I was like, look, it's just not for me. I respect that it's for other people. And then I said something very rude about Spider-Man the next day, and I think I upset Austin. He was actually a little mad at me, and I feel bad. I'm sorry, Austin. That's why he's not on the podcast today. He's still mad at me for saying something shitty about Spider-Man. Just kidding. Honestly... So as somebody who was targeted by Gamergate, as somebody who is a woman, visibly a queer woman on the internet, and gets a lot of death threats and die of cancer and all that kind of stuff, I think we all do if we're game journalists. But I do think there is something to be said for being a lady in these spaces sometimes can be a little harrowing. I went through a phase that was don't engage with the trolls. And that didn't work. I don't think there is a full winning strategy. I completely go with my gut. And there are some days where I feel like, no, okay, I'm not going to engage. I'm going to, you know, take the higher road and completely disengage from this. I'm going to completely not do this. And there are other days where I'm like, you know what? I'm mad. I know I'm right. I know I have the statistics to back up my arguments. I know I have the personal experiences as an EMT and someone who's gone through seeing family members die of opioid addiction to, you know, I have a watertight position here. I'm going to fucking stand up for myself. So occasionally, I would say one out of every 100, maybe, I don't know, if we'll put that as a number, is the ratio that I will engage with somebody. And then there's obviously the other end of this, which is, are people going to be sort of arguing with you in good faith, or is somebody just really trying to make you have a bad day? And that is completely a gut check, because you will never know. You will never know unless you know this person very personally, have conversations with them in different contexts. So that one is completely a crapshoot. So if you're going to get into a fight with somebody online, I would say, if you can, know your shit. Yeah. And know whether or not this is a battle you want to fight, and pick your battles. Getting into every one of these fights will make you want to die in short order. So pick them. Try to pick winners if you can.
The corollary I will offer to this is, if you are someone who often feels moved to get mad and be right on the internet and argue with people, consider, look deeply in the mirror before you sort of press onwards in your crusade, because like definitely there are moments where I've woken up the next morning and been like, wait, was I the asshole last night? Was like yeah. Was that tweet storm really warranted by that provocation, or did I just like, what was I, basically the pedantic, opinionated jerk who was getting up in somebody's mentions? Definitely, like, you know, I think in general it's good policy to not take part in too many of these fights. But man, on the other hand, some people just have it coming. So you know, especially when they're just really emotionally invested in holding a shitty position. Then that is tough to resist.
And the one thing I would say is, sometimes it's sometimes I find myself getting into those conversations, not because, don't think about it as winning or necessarily like convincing the other person, but it is sometimes useful to have those exchanges, even if they don't end in a place where someone says, oh, I learned something, but like just refining your argument, and being able to articulate what your argument is, because often, you know, I think a lot of us tend to hang out with people who, like, we're all on the same page about certain things. So it's like the conversation is not often about, like, why you feel that way. We all just agree because we're all on the same page. And I sometimes find it useful to have exchanges with hopefully, like, reasonable people. Like, I've actually found myself in, you know, post-Trump's election, like, I started following a lot more sort of, like, libertarian and conservatives that, like, aren't, like, on the alt-right, sort of, like, far-right, but, like, are folks that, like, have problems with Trump and but don't necessarily fall into, like, my sort of progressive politics. And I will occasionally find myself, like, especially folks that, like, don't have as many followers where, like, I feel like reasonably I can get them to respond to me. And, like, I've had, like, really good exchanges with folks who write for, like, really conservative publications that, like, it was an interesting back and forth. And we didn't necessarily end up agreeing, but it was pleasant and, like, forced me to, like, actually articulate my argument to someone who is predisposed to not agree with my side of the political spectrum. And I found them to be, like, really pleasant and forced me to refine and, like, especially doing it in Twitter over, like, 140 characters, like, really distill what I'm trying to say as succinctly as possible. And I found that useful.
Absolutely. I've had those as well, and they are wonderful. Or even the "hey, I'm a real human being" aspect of it is extremely useful. As like a "hey, you know what? Real people have had really different experiences for me, and it's really good to know what those experiences are, so I can consider that in my own life, in my own arguments, and sort of knowing what's going on in the damn world because it's a very complicated place." So yeah, I've found that very helpful as well. It's definitely a matter, Jesse. Question asker of finding which battles to fight and kind of how to conduct yourself. Oh, I think on that beautiful note, we took a couple of hard questions today. That
we
was
did, yeah. Oof. God damn it.
Oh, damn. All right, so we're gonna start doing our outro. But as always, we always tell people where you can find us on the internet if you want to have arguments with us. I am at Danielle RI. Patrick, how about
I'm
you?
I'm at Patrick Klippik.
And Rob, where are you?
Trapped in an endless nightmare subterfuge game of my own making. Also at Rob Zachney.
Excellent. Fantastic. Well, thank you so much to our producer, Tim Barnes. He's at TimBarnes451 on Twitter. Don't argue with him. He tells great jokes online, though. He's got some good-ass jokes, so you should follow him for those. It's fantastic. Thank you, and shout-outs to Bowen for letting us use the track Miss You off of the EP Pale Machine. You can go to waypoint.zone/Bowen for that. You can find all the good stuff and wonderful stuff and our shitposting at waypoint.vice.com. You can find all our good stuff at Waypoint on Twitter. And at Waypoint Vice on Facebook, Waypoint Vice on YouTube. There are a million redirects. I won't even attempt to go there, but I don't think that biz.nas goes there just yet. We'll work on that one. We'll work on that one. So everybody, thank you so much. We appreciate you listening. We appreciate you hanging out with us. And we appreciate your good and positive arguments on Twitter. So with that, I will say, be good or be good at it.
Peace.
Very good.
Wait, was I not supposed to go?
No, that's even better.
That was so good.
Rob, that was great. That was good. This podcast is over.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.